thank you for such a complete bell-ringing job. Good morning. I am Jonalu Johnstone, the developmental minister serving this wonderful fellowship. And whether this is your first visit or your 400th, you are welcome here. Unitarian Universalism strives to embrace and include all in a loving and caring community at the same time as we try to create a world that is diverse, hospitable, joyous, and just. Wherever you've come from, whatever your journey has been, it has led you here this morning, and we're glad to have you. I offer a special welcome this morning for National Coming Out Day. So if anyone wants to come out during joys and sorrows, you have a few minutes to think about it. Our service this morning continues a practice of occasionally welcoming members into the pulpit to share their personal spiritual journeys, and we're fortunate today to have a couple, Austin and Carrie Roberts, offer their reflections. And you may find parallels to your own journey. You may find you've been on an entirely different pathway. Our third Unitarian Universalist principle calls us to accept one another and encourage our spiritual growth. One way of doing that is to hear and honor one another's stories as we look for intersections with our own. It is good to be here together to listen and learn about one another and about the human journey. So please note the announcements that are in your order of service. I'd especially draw your attention to this morning's pancake brunch immediately following the service. Let's thank in advance the social committee, especially Courtney Albin, who chairs it, and all her many helpers. So thank you. Thank you. Are there people who were part of it? I know there were people who were part of it. So donations are accepted for the brunch, but visitors are welcomed free. And the organizers want you to form one line going out into the narthex. So I think they'll be serving the pancakes and sausages there, and then there'll be fruit and stuff in the Alsop room where we'll be eating. Later this afternoon, there are some community events to highlight sustainability. There was mention of in the newsletter, a solar panel install at the Ecumenical Campus Ministry from 1 to 3, and a potluck and film screening beginning at 5:30, and ask me about it if you have any questions. There's one correction to the order of service. The Just Mercy discussion is Thursday night, not Wednesday, and the regular game night's at 6:30, and I didn't mean to schedule a conflict, but I managed to do it, so I hope this works out okay. But anyway, we'll be doing a book study of the UUA Common Read, Just Mercy, at 7. And I would like to encourage everyone to attend the October 21st growth workshop, where no matter how little time you've been here, how much time you've been here, your input will be helpful. And we want to consider how we want to equip ourselves for inviting, welcoming, connecting, and deepening one another. Finally, one more correction. Our pianist today is Slavomir, not Renee, and we are very pleased to have him playing this morning. So I invite Jake to come up for our chalice lighting, and I borrow this chalice lighting this morning from Eric Heller Wagner. Blessed is the fire that burns deep in the soul. It's the flame of the human spirit touched into being by the mystery of life. It's the fire of reason, the fire of compassion, the fire of community, the fire of justice, the fire of faith. It is the fire of love burning deep in the heart, the divine glow in every life. And our opening hymn is number 361, Enter, Rejoice, and Come In.
Enter, rejoice, and come in. Today will be a joy.
Okay. So we're all meant to do something in the world, and sometimes it's hard to find just what that might be and how we might be. Today's story is spoon. So, this is spoon. This is spoon's family. All different kinds of spoons, exactly. On Sundays, Spoon goes to visit his Aunt Silver. He has to be on his very best behavior. She's very fancy and proper. Goodbye, darling. Ta-ta. At bedtime, Spoon likes to hear the story of the great adventure by his great-grandmother who fell in love with a dish and ran off to a distant land. Lately, though, Spoon has been feeling blue. What's wrong? Asked his mother. You look a bit out of shape. Nothing, mumbled Spoon. It's just that, I don't know, all my friends seem to have it better than me. Like Knife. Knife is so lucky, he gets to cut. And he gets to spread. I never get to spread or cut. Yes, Knife has it pretty spiffy that way. And then there's Fork. Fork is so lucky. She gets to go practically everywhere. Yeah, Fork does get out and make herself useful, doesn't she? With the salad and the grill and the cake. And then there's Chopsticks. Chopsticks are so lucky. Everyone thinks they're so cool and exotic. Those chopsticks really are something, aren't they? Meanwhile, if only Spoon knew what his friends were saying. Knife said, Spoon is so lucky, he's so fun and easygoing, everyone's so serious with me. And they're not allowed to be silly with me like they are with Spoon. And Fork said, Spoon is so lucky, he gets to measure stuff. No one ever does that with me. And Chopsticks, well, Spoon is so lucky he can go places by himself. We always have to be together. So that night after bedtime story, Spoon's mom turned off the light, tucked him in, and said, You know, Spoon, I wonder if you realize just how lucky you are. Your friends will never know the joy of diving headfirst into a bowl of ice cream. They'll never know what it feels like to clank against the side of a cereal bowl. And they'll never be able to twirl around the mug or just relax in a hot cup of tea. Spoon hadn't thought of it that way before. He lay awake in bed for a long time. There was only one thing to do. I can't sleep, he said. Come, Snuggle. Come, Spoon. And so he did. And they had sweet, sweet dreams. So you all can go to your classes now.
Oh, our hearts go with you. Go enjoy our hopes so too.
Shine your light in all.
part of our journeys, part of finding the connections and purpose of our lives, are the events that bring joy and sorrow into our lives. Sharing our joys magnifies them, while sharing our burdens lightens them. All the sharing weaves the webs of connection within the community. And now is the time for sharing of significant life events.
Well, Dolly, you remind me it was National Coming Out Day, though it's no secret. Yeah, I liked ladies.
So nobody can follow that, huh?
I did it in the early 90s, but I can come out again today.
Annell Furster, my wonderful traveling companion, and I went to New York last Friday, went to New Jersey, went into New York on Saturday and saw this wonderful painting. Also had a wonderful lunch where we could sit at, where we sat at a table and saw the Statue of Liberty very close by. And then we came back on Sunday.
So we hold in our hearts the joys and sorrows that are spoken and unspoken. An important practice of this congregation is our Helping Hands offering. Each month we invite a community organization that's living out our UU values in the world to present a bit about themselves and give us an opportunity to participate in their good work by supporting it through our offering. Last month, we gave $512.10 to CASA. And this month, our recipient is the Crisis Center, providing services to people experiencing domestic violence. And I believe Judy Davis is here to tell us about it.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me, for giving me the opportunity to thank you for your historic support, tangible and spiritual. As you know, we serve victims of sexual and domestic violence in the five-county region, and I'll give you a little sense of the magnitude of that. So far this year, our crisis hotlines have rung 1,590 times. In Riley County, a special cadre of volunteers is dispatched each time the police department dispatches patrol officers to a domestic violence call. In the first 9 months of the year, those police response advocates who sleep in their shoes responded 553 times. Our safe shelter, which is a lifeline for a significant percentage of those we serve, provided 4,003 nights of safe shelter during the first 9 months of the year. Excuse me. We will dedicate your gifts this year to support for our children's program. It's one of the things that has suffered from diminished public funding. I'm working to restore the children's advocate position to a full-time position, in order to assure that she has opportunity to work with each and every child of every victim we serve. Dixie asked me to speak specifically to other ways you can support the center, in addition to monetary gifts, which are very precious, but they're not the most important thing. There are other ways to engage. Many people make in-kind contributions, and I know some of you do. Betty Banner just brought us a bag of toiletries. There's a wish list on our website. Those are ongoing needs if you're interested. We also use volunteers in a variety of ways. We get 12,000 to 13,000 hours of volunteer service every year, and we do that training twice a year. The next one will be in February. Finally, I didn't think I was going to do this, but I really have to. You can be awake with us to the brutal social, and I know you are, to the brutal social policy that is now upon us, and think about the impact of that kind of policy on domestic violence victims who are incredibly vulnerable without the state being out to get them. I want to give you one specific example. And this describes many, many young women we've worked with in the last couple of years. As you know, there is now a 3-year lifetime limit on public assistance, temporary assistance for needy families, cash assistance. But that's just the start of it. Over and over and over again, women come to us, parents, who say, no more. I deserve better. My children deserve better. I'm not going back. We assist them in applying for TANF. In order to get TANF, they have to get a job that lets them work at least 28 hours a week. Notice that's not within their control. It's within the control of the employers. They have to get the job that lets them work at least 28 hours a week. They have children. In order to qualify for child care support, first they have to work that job at least 28 hours a week for at least 3 weeks, during which time the children, so they go back, because if nothing else, the abuser will provide some child care sometimes. Thank you. I apologize for the little rant, but
thank you.
invite you. Thank you very much. That was lovely. And I invite everyone to stand as willing and able.
We can sit for a couple minutes.
Oh, okay. Don't stand.
Don't stand.
Listen to
but
my
the choir is supposed to want to help come up. The piece that was we're playing is beautiful. We don't sing it very often. What we'll do is we'll ask Slavomir to play it through all the way. And then as that is coming to a conclusion, we'll ask you to stand and join us.
Good morning. I will do my best to live up to that buildup. But to give a full account of my personal spiritual journey would be pretty boring. Mine is a tale of taking a quarter century to piece together enough information to call myself a humanist. So there's a lot of dead space in the middle. But there are a few moments from my life that I've picked out, being especially noteworthy or formative, that I'd like to share this morning, and I hope that you'll get something from them as well. To start, when I was, I don't even remember how old, but in elementary school anyway, I attended a summer daycare of sorts. We would spend most days inside a public school gymnasium doing activities, but we would often go to the local swimming pool, or on the occasional field trip. For reasons beyond me to this day, one of those trips was to the Independence Temple, the headquarters of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, this building, whose magnificent spiral architecture dominates the surrounding skyline, must have been fairly new at the time, having been dedicated in 1994, and it did contain a fairly impressive interactive children's museum. Our group was divided up by the buddy system, and we were set loose inside. My buddy, half a pair of hyperactive twins, was immediately lost to me, likely off causing trouble with his brother. But that didn't matter. I was familiar and comfortable with this type of environment. I wandered alone, examining exhibits, just having a grand old time. I even found a wayward paper fan on the ground at one point and put it in my bag, intending to decorate it for my mother before leaving. Well, that didn't happen. I was a bit overstimulated myself. Sorry, Mom. But I did have fun that day. What wasn't so fun was the later announcement that two kids had stolen something from the museum. My buddy succumbed to temptation and take a pretty sweet shark hand puppet, and then I heard my name.
Yeah.
What? I hadn't stolen anything. I tried to protest my innocence, but the fan was produced from my bag. Apparently, it wasn't a fan at all, but a tool used to break light beams that generated different tones back at the museum. And because of this misunderstanding, I had to ride silently back from Shawnee, Kansas to Independence, Missouri, and wait in an intimidating office to apologize to whatever authority figure at the temple. I don't remember if I was lectured or rebuked, but I remember the feeling that no one was listening to me. I was too young to give adequate voice to my own defense, and the assumptions of those around me went unchallenged. It didn't matter that I had no intention to steal, and that I had I known the purpose of the item, I wouldn't have taken it. I was guilty by association with my buddy. I remember being labeled a thief, and a few later incidents at that daycare where my side of a story was not addressed, I suspect due to the staff's idea of me. At a young age, I learned intuitively and firsthand how preconceptions and misattributions of causation can have real, unfortunate effects. But cheer up, I turned out all right. It may even be the case that that experience was valuable and gave me some perspective. I can remember a very basic logic lesson later in elementary school. Now, yes or no, if a shape has four equal sides, it's a square. Yes, says the class. That's right, says the teacher. It could be a rhombus, said I. Again, I'd just seen a group of people make a mistake. They'd confused consistency with proof. To be fair, I was not thinking at that high of a level of elementary school. I had just learned that rhombus was a funny word for diamond, and that made it easy to remember. But the point stands. People make mistakes in groups and take the consensus as further evidence of being correct. Now, my family was never very religious or observant. We tried going to a local church for a time when I was younger. I was actually Joseph in a nativity play, so you can't say we were totally uninvolved. But for whatever reason, probably my young age and lack of reinforcement from my parents, the core teachings of Christianity never stuck. I mean, I probably loved my neighbor, but I wouldn't have thought to attribute it to Jesus. I had some nebulous idea that this religion business was important to people, but didn't give it much thought myself. Of course, the question of religion was bound to come up again later. Something happened to a friend of mine, one of my best friends to this day. He had just earned his Eagle Scout, minus some requirement of belief in a higher power. He, a young atheist before I had considered the concept, somehow got by citing some vague belief in nature. But to hear him tell it, it was him alone in a room with his troop leader, a four-hour-long attempt to get him to accept Jesus as his personal Lord and Savior. I was confused hearing it about the relevance of the religious test, and about why it was so important to believe in any case. I really didn't get it, but I did understand the concept of hell, and Pascal's wager had an effect on me. Why should I risk infinite torment based on my decidedly finite life? So I called myself an agnostic for many years. Besides, I had plenty of other stuff to worry about in high school. So it was that in the first few days of college, I agreed to attend Campus Crusade for Christ with a pleasant enough fellow that I met in the line for free hot dogs. I don't know what I expected from crew, but what I got was a theater full of Christian rock and people raising their hands in complete adulation of something I could neither see nor feel. It was confusing and a little scary. Don't get me wrong, these were nice and normal enough people outside of this particular behavior, but it kept me from forming any real connection with any of them. A few weeks in, I was welcome enough to be invited to play Capture the Flag, but still unknown enough that no one noticed when I simply turned around and walked backwards through enemy territory. The reactions to me winning the game this way made me feel more dishonest than clever, and ultimately alienated me from the group further. Eventually, one of them confronted me about whether I believed as they did, and that was the end of my association with crew. Having found nothing of value or substance in my admittedly shallow forays into religion, it was soon after that I began exploring the possibility that religion was in fact a product of the type of bad reasoning I'd experienced earlier in life. I started exploring atheism, starting with the so-called New Atheist books. I remember feeling a little guilty and scrutinized carrying the God delusion around. But thankfully, a bit of classical rationality had snuck into my video games. I played Civilization IV a lot in college, and each game I progressed my society far enough to research the scientific method, a congratulatory window would pop up, and Leonard Nimoy would read the following quote from Galileo. "I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use." Boy, was that the foot in the door. I read Christopher Hitchens' God is Not Great next, and prompted by my little brother, who is somehow way ahead of me on this, I began watching Hitch Slap videos on YouTube. To the uninitiated, these are powerful, one-sided montages of Christopher Hitchens' best insights and retorts in theological debate. I enjoyed them of themselves for a while. They are pretty entertaining. But then I began to dig deeper and watch the full debates the clips were pulled from. I started to watch a lot of YouTube related to theology, trying to investigate the issue from all sides. One of the most striking series of videos I found at the time was people taking the blasphemy challenge, expressly committing the supposedly unforgivable sin of denying the Holy Spirit. These people showed me that you can understand the concept of hell as an infinite negative consequence and still reject it as baseless. I still didn't understand why they would take even such a baseless risk for no benefit, but once I realized that the benefit was having an unfettered mind and providing an example to people such as me who had been bamboozled, that was the end of my just-in-case agnosticism. What had the greatest impact on me, though, was a little public call-in, or was a little public access call-in show out of Austin, Texas, The Atheist Experience. In particular, the host at the time remains one of the most impressive individuals I've ever had the privilege to learn from. Matt Dillahunty showed me depths to studies I'd merely been touching on, and he did it simply through asking callers what they believed in and why. The why was more important than the what. Understand, Matt had been a Southern Baptist, a fundamentalist Christian preparing for seminary and planning on devoting his life to ministry, but over time, in attempting to fulfill his obligation of 1 Peter 3:15, be at all times ready to give the reason for your faith, he realized his beliefs were unfounded. He then reevaluated everything he thought he believed. And he inspired me to do the same, because beliefs don't exist in a vacuum, and what we accept as true influences our actions. Unfounded beliefs may not map to reality, and actions based thereon can have the potential to cause untold harm. So I wanted to have a justification for everything I believed, but I was woefully unprepared for the consequences of attempting this. That immediately leads to an infinite regress. I couldn't maintain a never-ending list of justified justifications. So what began as an attempt at making sure what I believed was really true led to the conclusion that nothing can be proved absolutely. You might say that set me back. I was quite lost in the woods for a time until I learned about axioms. If you'll forgive me a brief lecture on the theory of knowledge, axioms are fundamental beliefs that, as a matter of practical necessity, aren't justified. Axiomatic beliefs are therefore core to a view of reality, and to call them into question is to call into question the entire belief structure that they support. They'd better be pretty basic and unassailable. Things that seem innate to the universe, such as the logical absolutes, qualify. After all, things are what they are and are not what they are not. That seems solid enough. More worrisome are axioms such as, my senses are generally reliable. That one is viciously circular. Any confirmation of my senses must be filtered through. You can see what I was dealing with at the time. But if absolute certainty is unattainable, maximal certainty is. And for all intents and purposes, maximal certainty is just as good, just with the nagging, unfalsifiable thought that we can never prove we aren't actually in the Matrix. Don't think about it. As long as our belief structure is on a solid foundation, is coherent, maps to reality, and produces good results, we can be reasonably assured that we do, in fact, know what we know. Great. I knew how I can kind of know some stuff. But the thing about starting from scratch is that I was reexamining everything. I was faced with the question of what to even base my values on. I found myself a philosophical nihilist, or one who doesn't see any inherent value in anything. Which isn't to say that I still didn't value things. I was still human, after all. Ooh, missed a page. I valued personal connections, liberty, anything we traditionally label as good. As a member of an evolved social species, I put great value on those things that contribute to human flourishing. And as I reflected on the human condition, I realized that that was enough. We're all born into this world knowing nothing, muddling our way through a universe that demonstrates no interest in us, trying to find happiness and meaning however we can. Our searching consciousness only has other consciousness to cling to, and we rise and fall together. Human flourishing, the well-being of conscious creatures, these are good bases for a moral system. They are subjective, yes, but to ask why flourishing and well-being are truly good is to hit philosophical bedrock with the shovel of a stupid question. And that revelation is why I started identifying as a humanist after almost 30 years. It's pretty funny when you think about it, how much work I did to conclude that my kindergarten teacher was right. I should care about people and try to be a good person myself. But I did gain a lot through my efforts. I learned the value of introspection, both in getting to know myself and as an error-checking mechanism. I gained confidence in my convictions, as well as the wisdom to know when I should withhold judgment. And perhaps most importantly, I gained an appreciation of just how difficult the process of changing a mind is. I will continue my attempts at sharing the value in what I've just relayed to you, and I won't be long discouraged by the initial rejections I'm bound to face. People are at different stages of development, and I have to, at the very least, allow them the same time I took myself. Because while I still strongly hold that unjustified beliefs are harmful, I can only empathize with those individuals that hold them. After all, they're also trying to do good the best they can. And so, with complete delight in the irony, I would like to conclude with a quote attributed to the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. There is no wealth like knowledge, no poverty like ignorance. Knowledge being justified, true belief. Thanks for listening. Be good to each other.
I invite you to open the hymnal to the back, to number 568, and read the part in italics as I read the part in non-italics. Connections are made slowly. Sometimes they grow underground. More than half a tree is spread out in the soil under your feet. Fight persistently as the creeper that brings down the tree. Gnaw in the dark and use the sun to make sugar. Live a life you can endure. Make love that is loving. Live as if you like yourself, and it may happen.
Reach out, keep reaching out, keep bringing in.
This is how we are going to live for a long time, not always.
After the planting, after the long season of tending the river, the harvest comes.
And words from Carrie.
Hi. What I have to say is not nearly so well thought out as what Austin said. We did not coordinate this at all, and I may not make sense, so bear with me. I wanted to start by reading a passage from the book American Gods by Neil Gaiman. I can believe things that are true and things that aren't true, and I can believe things where nobody knows if they're true or not. I can believe in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the Beatles and Marilyn Monroe and Elvis and Mr. Ed. Listen, I believe that people are perfectible, that knowledge is infinite, that the world is run by secret banking cartels and is visited by aliens on a regular basis. Nice ones that look like wrinkledy lemurs and bad ones who mutilate our cattle and want our water and our women. I believe that the future sucks, and I believe that the future rocks, and I believe that one day White Buffalo Woman is going to come back and kick everyone's ass. I believe that all men are just overgrown boys with deep problems communicating, that the decline in good sex in America is coincident with the decline in drive-in movie theaters from state to state. I believe that all politicians are unprincipled crooks, and I still believe they're better than the alternative. I believe that California is going to sink into the sea when the big one comes, while Florida is going to dissolve into madness and alligators and toxic waste. I believe that antibacterial soap is destroying our resistance to dirt and disease so that one day we'll all be wiped out by the common cold, like Martians in the War of the Worlds. I believe that the greatest poets of the last century were Edith Sitwell and Don Marquis, that jade is dried dragon sperm, and that thousands of years ago in a former life, I was a one-armed Siberian shaman. I believe that mankind's destiny lies in the stars. I believe that candy really did taste better when I was a kid, that it's aerodynamically impossible for a bumblebee to fly, that light is a wave and a particle, that there's a cat in a box somewhere who's alive and dead at the same time. Although if they don't ever open the box to feed it, it'll eventually just be two different kinds of dead. And that there are stars in the universe billions of years older than the universe itself. I believe in a personal God who cares about me and worries and oversees everything I do. I believe in an impersonal God who set the universe in motion and went off to hang with her girlfriends and doesn't know that I'm alive. I believe in an empty and godless universe of causal chaos, background noise, and sheer blind luck. I believe that anyone who says sex is overrated just hasn't done it properly. I believe that anyone who claims to know what's going on will lie about the little things, too. I believe in absolute honesty and sensible social lies. I believe in a woman's right to choose, a baby's right to live, and while all human life is sacred, there's nothing wrong with the death penalty if you can trust the legal system implicitly, and that no one but a moron would ever trust the legal system. I believe that life is a game, that life is a cruel joke, and that life is what happens when you're alive, and you might as well lie back and enjoy it. That was a really long quote, but it's probably better than everything else I have to say. So, I'm supposed to talk about how I got here, I think, where I came from, and how I ended up in this community. I hadn't ever thought of my upbringing as being religious. I wouldn't have said that my family's religious, but looking back on it, I probably spent half my life as a church-going person, and I guess I kind of just blocked it out. My earliest memories of going to church are of once-a-year Easter visits to a very, very tiny country church with my father's extended family. Of my father explaining to me that I couldn't participate in the communion because I hadn't been baptized. Of being given stale marshmallow peeps by a stranger who was in charge of me and about two or three other kids, and for years afterwards thinking that peeps were disgusting. That's what I got out of that experience. When I was still small, my family didn't go to any one particular church. I remember going to a bunch of different ones, sort of shopping around but not committing. I remember liking the ones that had Sunday school during the service, so I didn't have to sit through the boring stuff. And it was even better if they had donuts. And in elementary school, we started attending a Disciples of Christ church in Shawnee, Kansas. It was Shawnee Park, if anybody knows where that is. When we became members, I remember my father telling me that my sister and I were now the seventh generation in our family to be members of the Disciples of Christ. This place was big enough to have two separate services with Sunday school kind of sandwiched in the middle, which meant the kids had to sit through the service too. They gave us little binders with like coloring paper to keep us quiet. And I remember sitting in those services with my binder, drawing pictures, making up my own gods and goddesses because I could. It was better than paying attention. And I was trying to make sense of the world on my own terms, and I did not see the irony in creating my own pagan pantheon in a church service until way later. Anyway, when we joined that place, the minister was a woman, and I remember that being a big deal to my parents, because apparently that wasn't something they usually saw. I don't know. While we were there, I participated in all of those things you have to do when you're a kid and your family goes to church. So Sunday school, vacation Bible school, church camp, terrible Christmas pageants. I think one year I got a speaking role, and I was the ditzy weather lady on a Christian news network. It was pretty bad. There were other kids my age there, but I don't remember them. I did not have friends there. They all went to the same school, and I went to a different one. Being in the same place once a week wasn't enough to overcome not having anything else in common. I skipped ahead. Hold on a second. Another thing I remember about sitting in those church services is looking around at the room that was bigger than this, totally full of people, and wondering if they really believed all the stuff they were talking about. Like, really? I couldn't imagine what that must be like. It was just so weird. I don't know where I came up with that, but it's one of my earliest church memories consistently. When I was in middle school, I declined to participate as my peers took confirmation-type classes and got baptized. My mother actually took those classes and was baptized at the same time. I remember watching that happen, thinking how weird it was that getting dunked into a hot tub they kept in a shed behind the church building was such a big deal. I knew what it was supposed to mean. I tried to feel whatever it was that I assumed they must be feeling, but I never could. Eventually, I asked to be left home on Sunday mornings. I still didn't have any friends there, and being home alone for 2 hours a week was infinitely more inviting. And that's what happened. My family went without me for a while until they stopped going too, saying that since the original minister had left and the new one came, the church had changed. The new minister was a man. It was getting a lot more conservative. It was almost evangelical and very different from when they started. So we didn't go for a while. When I started high school, we tried a new church. It was another disciples church, this time in Olathe. They didn't have a building yet. They were meeting in a school when we started going. I didn't mind it at first. It was smaller, more socially liberal, and it seemed to have a stronger sense of community. They had decided they needed their own space, and for a while it was all fundraising all the time. I liked helping out at the building site, and it was fun to watch the construction progress. The building itself turned out beautifully. It was one of those hay bale, like stacked hay bale constructions that they spray concrete with, so the walls are like this thick, and it's like a It was like a Spanish-themed castle-type-looking building. But as soon as it was done, they realized it wasn't big enough. So instead of less fundraising, it was more, because they had to, like, double the size, basically. And that kind of... I lost whatever interest I had left in it. The youth group, again, all went to one school while I went to another. And the teen materials were just awful. It was like the mid-90s. There was adults trying to make Jesus cool. It was bad. So I again stopped going before the rest of my family. I think I only went there for maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And my parents didn't last a whole lot of time after I left. I'm not sure what their reasons were, but they just seemed to be done with church in general. And I was busy with high school and part-time jobs, and then later community classes on top of everything, or community college classes on top of everything else. So being part of a religious community wasn't even on my radar. It just wasn't a factor in anything. I was trying to figure out what I did believe in, though. The church stuff never stuck. It never made sense to me. And this is where what I have written down really starts to lose cohesion. So let's see what happens. For a while, I was actively trying to find a religion that matched up with the things I was thinking about. I wasn't looking for a church to join or a community to be a part of. I just wanted to know that someone at some point had made the same sense of things that I was making. And I assumed there must be some system out there. I just had to find it. So I went to the public library. I brought home like stacks and stacks of books from their religion section, read through all of them, trying to find one that I agreed with. And ultimately, I decided that it was unquestioned belief that was making me uncomfortable. Someone once told me that religion is a search for truth. I know that's not the dictionary definition, but it's the one that I use for myself. It's active. It's not passive. The systems of belief I had come in contact with so far were all about receiving something or about accepting something external as it's given to you, completely without question. If there are so many different religions and they all claim to have the truth, to be the right one, then how can any of them be? I had found things I agreed with in a lot of the traditions I was reading about. It seems like they had all found pieces of it, but were almost in denial about others that seemed totally obvious to me. If I had found a UU at this point, it would have been better. But I didn't. So what exactly was it that I was looking for? I knew from a young age that religious and especially biblical texts can't be taken literally. The churches we went to did not hold the Bible as the literal word of God, and I think I was kind of flabbergasted when I learned that there were people who do that. When I was still fairly young, one of my father's hobbies was translating the ancient Greek Bible into English. And so he would tell me all of these differences that he would come across between the words he was, you know, working with and the version that we were used to looking at. Translators often had their own agendas and managed to edit things out they didn't like or agree with, most notably being the feminine aspect of God, which is kind of a big deal. And then the original books themselves had obviously been created by people as products of various social and political environments. It deserves to be questioned, and I didn't see Christianity doing that. So despite my family still celebrating Christmas every year, I came to the conclusion that I was probably not a Christian. I was on the fence about a lot of stuff then, and I still am. I sort of wanted to be pagan for a while. but ultimately realized that having multiple gods made as much sense for me personally as just one. I sort of wanted to be Jewish for a while, too. I was really into archaeology for a while, long enough to get a bachelor's in it. And while I was still in high school, someone recommended that I read The Source by James Michener. If you guys are familiar with his books, they're pretty comprehensive, if fictional. I've read that one 3 or 4 times now. It holds up. It's more or less an episodic history of an imaginary town in Israel, and it's also a fictionalized history of Judaism. I eventually decided that while I have a massive amount of respect for the Jewish people, most of that was directed at the depth of their traditions and the fact that they don't proselytize. They don't go out and recruit. You're either Jewish or you're not, end of story. And I respect that. So, from a certain point of view, I don't believe in God. So why not just say I'm an atheist? Well, I don't think the Abrahamic version of God is out there floating around and being pompous, but I do think there's something. I believe that we're all connected. I have no explanation for how or why, it just feels true. If such a thing as God exists, then that connection must be it. I don't know if it's life or gravity or Jung's collective unconscious, but I can feel there's something there. And it's weird for me because, you know, all of these religious communities that I've supposedly been a part of, I never connected with anybody on a personal level, but I always felt a general connection to people. And it's hard for me to explain that dissonance, but it's there. I thought I was really clever when I came up with this. Years ago, I was thinking about the expression, no man is an island. I've spent a large percentage of my life feeling depressed and alone. And I think somebody probably said this to me a few times trying to cheer me up. It didn't work. But I started thinking about islands. Islands aren't actually separate from each other. They're not floating on the surface. They go all the way down. They're all part of the earth, part of the same whole. They only look different from out in the air. So I concluded, maybe people are islands, all of us. Maybe we're all part of one big ball of humanity, and we only think we're separate from each other because we can only see the parts that stick above the water. The water in this case being our perceivable reality, I don't know. But that thought did make me feel a little better for a while. After college, when I was out in the world trying to adult, the recession hit and I lost my job. It was the first job I'd ever actually liked. My coworkers were also my friends, but those friendships faded over the next several months. My 25th birthday happened. A long-term, almost relationship finally ended, and I was unemployed and considering if it was even worth finishing my master's. This was one of my lowest points, and it was really rough. I basically sat in my underwear in my apartment eating pudding for a few months. It wasn't pretty. I was living in Kansas City, and my whole family was here. I didn't have any kind of support network, but I knew I needed one. Eventually, I found the courage to go out in the world and try to make friends. That sounds really stupid, I know, but it was a really big deal for me. It was terrifying, and I failed at it. As a last-ditch effort, I tried going to church, sort of. I had read some dense academic Buddhist writings about meditation in college, and while I wasn't sure if it was really going to fit, I was also really, really bored and lonely. I knew of a Buddhist center near downtown Kansas City, so I went. I ended up going fairly regularly for about a year. And it actually helped pull me part of the way out of the mental pit that I was trapped in. I agreed with the basic Buddhist teachings. I liked a lot of the thought processes there, mindfulness, following the middle way. I've heard that when asked about the existence of a supreme being, the Buddha either remained silent or equivocated. There are multiple versions of that story with multiple interpretations, but mine is simply that, does God exist, is not the right question to be asking. That kind of makes me feel better, too, about not knowing. I found the meditation helpful. I enjoyed the chanting and the flow of the weekly services they held on Sundays. They had outreach programs in prisons and supported Tibetan refugees in India. And a few times a year, they distributed backpacks full of socks and gloves and granola bars and toothpaste to the homeless around town. But I still wasn't actually connecting with individual people. New people were becoming members constantly, but the weekly attendance there was always about the same. People just didn't stick around. And after a while, it started to look to me more like a tourist attraction than anything else. They even have a gift shop. Not joking. When I tried to become more involved as a volunteer, thinking maybe that would get me somewhere, I was told that they didn't need anyone. All the volunteer positions were full. And I was still having some of those, do these people really believe all this moments? Bowing to the shrine made me feel slightly uncomfortable. And eventually the stuff that bothered me, all of the above combined with the fact that it was Tibetan Buddhism being practiced by a bunch of rich suburban white people, meant that when I moved back to Manhattan, I didn't really miss it. It had served its purpose and gotten me out of my darkest place, and then I moved past it, and I was looking for something else. I didn't find a Buddhist community here in Manhattan, so I just kind of stopped looking for a while. Then I met that guy, which was good. I finished my master's, got a job, a real job, for the first time in several years, and things were starting to look good. But I still didn't really have a group of friends in the area. Most of my social interaction was with my mother, so. As Austin and I were preparing the service for our wedding, we were looking for readings, and I found one online by a UU minister. And initially I was like, oh, it's a minister. I don't know. Then I looked up what UU was, and, you know, I was initially thinking, Unitarianism, that's Christian. That makes me feel weird. But it wasn't. And I was like, maybe there's a place like that here. And we found the website of this, and it had that picture of Michael Nelson on a sled on the front page, which, I don't know, that kind of clinched it for me. Like, we had to go. I had to see what this was. Austin was not sure. I had to talk him into it. He wanted nothing to do with church whatsoever. But I knew that we were going to want a family, and we were going to need people. And we came, and you guys were here, and everybody was awesome. And we kept coming back, and we're still here. And I'm going to start crying, so I'm going to stop talking. Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. I think those are both wonderful stories, and the way that they come together is wonderful, too. Let's stand as willing and able and join in hymn number 300, With Heart and Mind.
Thank you.
closing words are from Amy Zucker Morgenstern. As we leave this hallowed place, may our feet remember its feel, so that wherever we walk, we know ourselves to be on hallowed ground. May we know that we are kin with every soul, every star, every stone, and leaf of grass. And may our words be gentle and our touch be kind. Blessed be.